Shall I? Do you want to go first? Because then you do the, and this is You Know What We Like, and then we do You Know What We Like Frankenstein, and then I start off the introduction.
Cool, sounds good to me.
I'm really glad you could make sense of that.
I mean, like, it's been 5 years at this point, so.
I know, I just like that. I was like, ba-da-ba-da-ba-da, and you were like, yes.
Yeah. I go ba-da-ba-da-ba-da, then you go ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. Cool, yeah, cool. On the same page. Hey, I'm Mark.
Hi, I'm Sophie.
And this is You Know What I Like, where we sit down each month and flail about something that we are unhealthily obsessed with.
You know what I like.
And you know what I like.
Frankenstein! Yay. Frankenstein was a novel written by Mary Shelley in 1818. Originally published anonymously, but with an introduction by her husband, Percy B. Shelley, he received implicit credit for the novel until the second edition in 1821.
Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus, to use its full title, tells the story of the creation of the monster known in popular culture as Frankenstein, but who actually receives no name in the original novel, and is referred to as the creature, the monster, or the wretch. Victor Frankenstein, the scientist, creates the creature, but then flees from it, disgusted by what he has achieved.
The most iconic image of Frankenstein comes from it as portrayed by Boris Karloff in the 1931 movie, and who would play the monster in two further sequels, Bride of Frankenstein and Son of Frankenstein, and be associated with the franchise for decades to come. Both the use of electricity and the cobbled-together image of Frankenstein's monster were more the result of this film adaptation of the story rather than from the original novel. Traditional question. What is your experience with Frankenstein?
So, I feel like you don't have to say that you're aware of Frankenstein. I feel like that's assumed.
Yeah.
Just for everyone. can we say that for some things? But for this, you've just heard of it.
Yeah.
But I'd not read it until, 2 months ago, maybe? When I don't remember what prompted me to buy the book.
It was me.
Oh, was it you?
I said, wouldn't it be good if we did a podcast episode on Frankenstein? I'm giving you 2 months' notice to buy and read the book.
Why are you so offended?
How dare you not remember every single conversation we have, Mark?
Yes, it was you, you're right. And I had what I feel like everyone in the modern day must have, where you begin reading it and you're like, where's the castle? Where are the angry mob from somewhere in Eastern Europe? Where are the pitchforks and torches? Where's the, I'm alive? No.
It's alive.
It's alive! I'm alive! You know, it's the moment where you're this... somewhere through pop culture has been entirely, not mangled, just changed. And it definitely feels like the original book is unrecognizable from what the general view of Frankenstein is. Even going just beyond the naming thing, Frankenstein's monster, just the perception of it as a piece of media just feels so separate from what it actually is.
Yeah, it's definitely taken on a life of its own as a cinematic entity versus what that original book was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How about you?
I first read Frankenstein many years ago now, actually. In between my first and second year of university, I decided that I wasn't doing enough reading for fun. And so I was just set myself I think it was about 10 books. And I was I'm going to read these 10 books. And one of them was Frankenstein because I was trying to read more classics. So I was let's go for a classic. Let's read Frankenstein. And again, I really liked it because I really liked romanticism is a genre that sort of like, I like some authors in it and I don't like other authors in it. And Mary Shelley was such an icon that I was like, I can't believe I've never read anything by this person. And I really enjoyed what Frankenstein turned out to be versus what I had it. I knew it was going to be different from the films because I was sort of aware that there was like a difference between them. But I just sort of really enjoyed experiencing what it actually was.
Had you seen the films at all? Like any media that had him in it?
I feel like I inevitably must have watched, like, there's so many things which riff off of Frankenstein. You know, even, like, from, like, down to, like, Simpsons episodes and stuff like that, you know, like, I feel like I will have watched, like, cartoony things that are playing around with it and that sort of thing. I didn't consciously watch Frankenstein film adaptations and stuff like that until after I'd read the book. But again, that might be me fudging my memory slightly because, again, it is one of those things that is there's such a cultural knowledge of it imbued already.
See, though, would you say that like you've seen cartoon riffs on the book or on the original film?
On the original film.
Yeah, yeah. Because like what comes to mind is just like that black and white storm at night castle, like it's alive scene, like, yeah. Is the one that always gets riffed on.
Like he's green and he's got bolts in his neck and a yes. square head.
Yeah.
But then film adaptations that I have watched since reading it, I've watched some of those classic like Hammer horror type things like Bride of Frankenstein, stuff like that. I have also watched ones that like Frankenstein, oh, I don't remember what year it was made, but there's a Frankenstein film which is very much an adaptation of the book rather than a continuing of this film mythos style.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say like is your main takeaway or like opinions of the book?
I really like it. I really like the way it becomes, this is not a groundbreaking thing to say, but that the message of the book is that the monster is not the monster, you know, like, you know, it's this navigation of playing with powers outside of your control, the repercussions of that. And then, you know, you read Frankenstein and the creature does terrible things, but equally so does Victor. And, you know, it's almost like this tragedy. This tragic tale whereby Frankenstein suffers for his like his hubris is like the suffering that he gets from aiming to be play God and then running away from the creation that he makes and that sort of thing and then unleashing that upon himself and his loved ones and that sort of thing. So I really just enjoyed like all of these topics it explores about like humanity and mortality, and it is a classic for a reason. You know, sometimes you read classics and you're like, I kind of get why at the time this was really groundbreaking. And I see why at the time it was really relevant, but as a modern reader, it just doesn't hold up type things. Yeah. Whereas I feel like Frankenstein is a text that you can read as a modern reader, and the points it's making still come across so clearly, and I still understood why it is a text that has been returned to for so long.
Mm-hmm. Like I feel like the themes that like you mentioned that we have seen in like other things, like in like a lot of zombie media where the theme is like what if the monster is man, that I feel like this book, even though it probably did it first, like it still feels like a fresh take on it because it is so heavily focused on Victor Frankenstein versus the creature. Like, and isn't this thing that where like you have to work through like either like a bleak series of deaths, even though that is some part of it. Like, it doesn't feel like a gratuitous way, like a lot of zombie films tend to be. Like, it feels like each death that occurs and each time the plot does escalate, it's like showing you that Victor has gone through a stage of the process of learning that he is in the wrong here.
Yeah, and oftentimes it's a direct cause and effect. He creates the creature, he runs away and leaves the creature. As a result, the creature kills X person. And equally, like, the creature asks him to make him a mate. He then ends up not going through with that. Therefore, the creature kills X person. It's very like each death is meaningful and it is both a process, a step along the way for both Victor and the creature's growth that then culminates in like this final crescendo moment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One thing that I really liked about what the book did, like in terms of its structure, is it felt a lot like the process of Victor losing his mind in the same way that you see in like a Lovecraft book, where like a lot of the time where you are in that place where you're questioning, like, is this what really happened? Or is it just like his perception of what happened, and he has all this guilt and remorse that he's processing, where he's projecting the creature following him all the time. Because, like, the moment that deals with that strongly is when he makes the creature. And, like, you don't really get, like, a strong description of the process that he's going through, which could have just been she didn't want to get things wrong, and then you're like, oh, that doesn't make any sense. But, like, it also just works really well to show you that when he's doing that process, he's in, like, a fervor.
Mm.
And he's, like, he's not really keeping track of what he's doing. He's just kind of doing things. And then you get to the point where, like, he realizes what he's done, is horrified about it, and then just runs away. Part of you is like, I don't understand what just happened. I just know that it was bad.
Yeah.
And, like, you get that sense throughout, like, a lot of his encounters with the creature, or ones that he describes as being, like, encounters with the creature, where you're like, I don't understand where a lot of this has come from, but because you are telling it to me. Like, it comes back to that unreliable narrator sense of things, where, like, a lot of the story is Victor telling us the story. So, like, it has that cloud, like, and that lens.
And if it wasn't for the fact that at the very end, our actual narrator, after Victor has died, sees the creature, like, the creature takes his body, if it wasn't for that moment, you could write it all off as just being completely an invention of Victor. Whereas because she puts that moment in at the end where it's like our other guy has seen this creature, it sort of then like solidifies that at least to some extent it is true, whether or not that extent is the complete fullest that as you were given it.
Like, it's the kind of thing that happens when you're like interpreting like unreliable narrator things, where it's like, is this all like an invention of that first narrator? Because like the framing is he's writing some letters home to his sister, and like it could be either he's just having some fun with his sister and is like making up a story, or like he's going mad because they're trapped in the ice and the snow for months. But while that could be true, I feel like it falls like in the camp of it's not as interesting a story. Like, in the sense where, like, if it could all be a dream or a lie. Like, you know, like in Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun, where, like, it's being told by the dictator of the country. And it could, like, all just be a lie to give him the grounding to prove why he is the dictator of the country.
Yeah.
But that's just not as interesting a story.
Yeah, it's always like with Alice in Wonderland, where everyone's like, she just took drugs. It's like, yeah. Well, great, like, it could be that, but then it does take away from it somewhat if it's all just a trip, you know? Like,
yeah, what's the point of this book now?
Yeah, at some point I'm like, I see that. I see that you could technically argue that. It's more mm-hmm. fun if we don't.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like if you're just telling the story of a guy who had some like ice hallucinations,
yeah,
that is not as deep to talk about or to think about. It's just like he went a bit mad.
It's a fun angle, and you're like, oh yeah, I see what you're saying, but equally like, but I don't really care, because what I care about is like, let's look at these discussions within the text. Like, even if it is all an ice hallucination, we're grappling with some like heavy stuff, let's talk about that type thing.
Yeah So would you say that Victor Frankenstein is a character that is, like, easy to empathise with? Even though he is, like, arguably the villain.
It's tricky because if we're sticking to just, like, a strictly book interpretation, like, I often found him, both on my first reading and on this reread, quite annoying.
Okay. In what sense?
To start with, why you gonna build a dead guy? Okay. And then be like, as soon as you've brought him to life, suddenly be like, oh, you know what? I'm going to fuck off. Mm-hmm. Like, what did you think you were doing?
I get that. You know? Yeah. Like, there's a lot of, like, when you first read through it, like, and you're like, if you just took the responsibility for your actions, none of these things would happen.
And it falls into that tricky trap where, like, half the time I'm like, I wish you would just communicate with people. So with like his fiance, and they get married, and he's like, I will tell you everything the day after our wedding. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, what if you told her everything before she legally commits to being your wife?
Yes.
Wouldn't that be good? But then equally, I also do understand the fact that, like, were he to sit down and be like, I made a living person out of dead people who is now hunting me across the lands, you know, like,
sure,
yeah. You know, and it's like that thing where I'm like, I understand also, like, you need to have a conceit for the novel to set upon, and if he just, like, sat down and had a chat and everything was fine, there would be no novel. At the edges, I found him, like, just occasionally I was like, why are you making these decisions? I don't understand you.
Like, it's a book that couldn't really have, like, a redemption arc, you know, like it ends in the only way that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, in just this, like, self-destruction of both of them.
Yeah, because I think one thing I struggled with Victor Frankenstein's character is just the absolute, like, revulsion he feels towards the creature.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was at university, one of my lectures once talked about this concept of, like, the grotesque. How sometimes grotesque things, we associate it with things that are, like, really disturbing, but also sometimes it's something that's associated with, like, absolute sublime beauty. We had this whole discussion about, like, this concept, and she talked about Frankenstein, and she talked about how there is an interpretation whereby the creature that he has created, what makes it repulsive to him is not that it's, like, this disgusting, horrible thing, but that he's actually created this really beautiful pinnacle of life, and that in itself is what then causes him to recoil. It's like it's too perfect type thing.
Okay.
Which is not necessarily an argument that I'm putting forward as something that I believe.
Uh-huh.
It's just ever since she talked about that, it's really affected how I then read those scenes of him, like, recoiling, because you're like, is he recoiling because he's made this absolute horror of a thing and he's, like, absolutely horrified by what he's done and that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it kind of the other thing where he's made this guy who technically, like, can withstand things that the human body can't withstand, is very intelligent because he can pick up this speech quite easily and stuff like that. Like, mm-hmm. has he actually created, like, a new pinnacle of life? But it's just, like, too horrifying as a result.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, like, I would like to see if I could reread it with that in mind and see if that, see like if that changes things.
Do you find Victor Frankenstein a sympathetic or empathetic character? Like, how do you feel about him?
I feel like it works well from the point of just, it's like an exaggerated version of that when you make a mistake and you don't want to own it, and it just grows and grows and grows, because you do see him with all of this guilt and remorse, but he also is also quite cruel, and, like, he doesn't seem to, even with the person who he marries, and he is, like, at that point so destitute and so desperate for some kind of validation, he never really gets to a point where he is fully sympathetic, because he always just begins to make steps. So, like, he always has points where he always has, like, a bunch of, like, opportunities to change his situation, but he never takes them. And I feel like that stops him from becoming a character who you can be, like, he's someone to emulate. He's that character who you're meant to look at and think, like, he's making these bad choices, like, over and over and over again. So, like, I don't find him, like, inspirational, but I do find him compelling.
Yeah, he's definitely an interesting character. And then especially when you contrast him with the creature and the creature's actions as well, like, there's an interesting, like, interplay between the two of them and how they go about things. The creature, in many ways, doesn't feel the level of remorse that Victor feels. The creature has, you know, killed people and is just full of, like, anger and blah, blah, blah. But equally, in many ways, you look at the creature and you're like, well, no one's shown you how to be a person.
Yes. Even though he doesn't show the remorse for the horrible things he's done, he's still more sympathetic. Because, like you've said, like, it feels like he doesn't know what else to do. And it feels like he is more innocent in that regard. Whereas, like, you can see through Victor's perspective that he knows what he probably should do, but he does the opposite instead.
Yeah. And in many ways, it's like having a giant super-powered baby who is attempting to, like, but you know, like, he's attempting to understand the world and to act accordingly and appropriately and stuff. It's just like he is met with cruelty at many turns, therefore he starts to respond with cruelty to things. You see how it could have been different. Like, if one person, any one of these people, didn't necessarily have to be Victor, could have been, like, that family, stuff like that. But maybe if one person had continually shown kindness, it might have gone differently.
You saying that has made me realise the similarities that this book has to the structure of Carrie by Stephen King.
Yeah.
You know, like, where, like, a lot of the problems could be solved if just someone was kind to the main character.
And kind for the right reasons. Like, yeah. Carrie, and we had this discussion in our Carrie episode, go listen if you're interested.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie, there were acts of kindness, but often they were motivated in ways that weren't genuine kindness. Like, the girl asks her boyfriend to ask to take Carrie to prom,
yeah.
But she asks because she feels guilty for being involved in a bullying incident.
Mm-hmm.
When Victor agrees to make a partner for the Frankenstein monster creature thing, and you're like, if that was motivated by a genuine desire that, like, you've created this being and this being is so desperately lonely that it just, the act of making it a companion to spend its days with would increase its quality of life, that it maybe wouldn't be murdering people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if that was the motivation, maybe things would have been different. But actually the motivation was, oh, I just want you to fuck off and leave me alone and I'm going to make this thing and then I'm going to decide that actually I'm not going to make you this thing and blah, blah, blah. Like, and then it just, like, falls and it, like, disintegrates in front of your very eyes. In many ways, we are talking about the exact things that the book wants us to talk about.
Like, oh, yeah.
Masterfully done from a writing standpoint.
Yes. She has a very purposeful way of writing where she manages to cover all of these complex topics in this, like, heightened way. Like, I see why some people call it the first science fiction book, because it's like all these themes and messages that you can talk about in, like, an exaggerated form.
And themes and messages, which I think sci-fi still explores, just mm-hmm. in more obviously science fiction fantasy ways.
Yep. Now I'm just thinking, is Frankenstein in space a thing? Like, it must be a thing, surely.
We're just like any offshoot. We're like, Frankenstein versus Dracula, Frankenstein in space, Frankenstein in sea, Frankenstein on the moon, you know, like.
Those have to be things.
They've got
surely
to be things.
Like Frankenstein versus Dracula on the moon.
Yeah.
So in the vein of transforming a franchise, I thought that, like, it would be a good idea to talk more generally about, like, adaptations of well-known works and how they do and don't work well, which, like, I feel like we have covered in the past in various forms.
Yeah.
So, like, in the vein that reading Frankenstein after the general public awareness of Frankenstein is a very different, like, experience, do you have anything where you want people to read the original source because you feel like the general, like, awareness of it is incorrect?
I wanted to talk about how I feel having read Dracula and watched some Dracula adaptations recently.
Mm-hmm.
There's an aspect of Dracula from the original text that I find really compelling that I feel like is not commonly done in adaptations of Dracula. What this is essentially the way that Dracula is introduced. So I have watched quite recently, I've watched the Bram Stoker's Dracula, that is the one with Keanu Reeves in, and then I also watched the first episode of the most recent, I think it was released 2020, with Mark Gatiss, Stephen Moffat Dracula series. Both of them, when you first meet Dracula, he is so obviously a shady dude.
Okay.
It's like the entire way it is framed, you're like, alarms going, do not trust this guy, he's dodge. Whereas I read the original Dracula, and actually, he is so chill at the start.
Okay.
There's a lot of building tension as, like, Jonathan Harker is, like, traveling to the castle. And, like, everyone keeps, like, giving him, like, crosses and being like, oh, everything looks dodged. And then he arrives and Dracula's actually quite a nice guy. He's like, come, put your feet up, have a meal. It must have been a long journey, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found really effective about the start of Dracula, the book, is the creeping suspense and dread that builds as it becomes increasingly revealed to you that there is more going on. So this guy who initially seems like a really welcoming host, and then you're like, oh, but only hang out in these rooms, don't go in these rooms after dark. And then it's like, oh, actually, you can't leave the castle anymore, the door's locked.
Okay.
And it's just like this increasing, like, oh, now I found you asleep in a coffin on a pile of grave dirt, isn't that a bit weird, you know, like the tension builds. Whereas a lot of Dracula adaptations, it's like you start off at a 10 and then there's nowhere to go.
Okay.
So that opening scene, to me, in a lot of film adaptations I've seen, lacks that increasing suspense and dread. And I wonder if that is because Dracula, like Frankenstein, has so entered modern consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You as a modern reader are watching it and you're like, okay, well, it's Dracula. He's a dodgy guy. Conversely, I would say that the latter half of Dracula, the book, is very slow and boring and then suddenly wraps up in 3 pages and was a bit of an anticlimax.
Okay.
So in many ways, like, there are a lot of good film adaptations that really speed that shit up,
mm-hmm.
and give a better climax. So it's like one of those texts that I don't want to come down and 100% be like, you should choose the book over films, because there are many aspects of film adaptations that are much better than the original text. It's just like a lot of the earlier passages, I feel like they give you a lot more suspense, horror, and dread, and they let you sit with it a little bit more than modern adaptations sometimes do. How about you? Do you have anything that you're like, oh my god, yes?
So, like, the obvious one that jumped out to me was the general perception, like, of the X-Men as a team. Because, like, I feel like from the cartoon, like, in the 90s, and from a lot of the recent-ish movies, they're, like, 20 years old now, but I feel like the general sense of the X-Men is as people who are, like, basically, like, big action heroes, where, like, they go into a confrontation, and, like, all they do is, like, punch and yell and fire beams and cool powers and stuff. And while that is some of what they do, like, it's the same kind of thing where, like, it's not all that they do. And I feel like it might just be, like, again, the form in which it is. Given the fact that, like, a lot of X-Men is, like, a serialized comic that can come out over years and years and years, each moment can't just be full of adrenaline. And, like, you get to have, like, all of these quiet moments that show you the characters more than you get to see when they're, like, blasting the head off a sentinel. And I feel like because of the brand name, the X-Men is so well known, that you don't get to see all of the, like, offshoots of the teams that I feel like I love more than the core team, because, like, brand recognition is, like, such a huge thing, where, like, it would have to be called, like, X-Men colon, like, Excalibur or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And just, like, people are so reluctant to take a risk in film because it is so expensive to do, that, like, it's so rare to be able to get a chance to see all of these teams and characters and dynamics and adventures that people are just not ever gonna get to see, because people have this perception of, like, who is on the team, how do they interact, you know, like, they have all these preconceptions that people just don't want to go against. And that makes me feel sad. One example that I thought of with, like, adaptations where I don't want them to, like, adhere too closely to the book is, strangely enough, what you mentioned earlier with, like, Alice in Wonderland, where if I see something that is, like, a straight, like, adaptation of the book, I don't really want to watch it, because it feels like the book does it so perfectly that I'm like, I don't need to see this story again. And it lends itself so well to adaptation that it feels like almost like laziness to be, I'm just going to do the book. I'm like, yeah, like, I've read the book, but, like, what are you going to do with it?
Yeah.
Have you got anything where you like the, like, adaptations more than the original?
I had that with Bridget Jones' Diary, actually. Okay. Specifically, like, one thing that I really struggled with it was how often calorie counting was talked about. There is an aspect in the film about Bridget trying to lose weight and that sort of thing. It was just so much more glaringly obvious in the books. And I think in part that's because, like, the film has kick-ass soundtrack, endearing actors, you know? And it, like, peels away some of that. So there are scenes where Bridget's standing on a scale and she's like, oh, I'm so fat. And then you look at the number on the scale and you're like, you're literally a size 10 woman. What is wrong with you? Like, there is that, because it is a product of its time and that sort of stuff. However, I find it so much easier to forgive it in the film than I did when I read it as a book.
I have the same thing with Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah.
Where, like, I loved the film and then I read the book and I was like, the film's a lot better. Can we watch that film and then just not even do like an episode on it? Just watch that film again.
Just add it on the list for the next.
Yeah.
It's going to be Devil Wears Prada and a Cinderella story on our next hangout.
Okay. Shall we just use this podcast to make plans and then just like upload it afterwards?
When we can make plans.
Yeah.
So, Devil Wears Prada is obviously canonically one of the best films ever made.
Of course.
Shall we talk about the literary canon?
Okay.
Would you like to take the lead? Or, like, do we want to go down the angle of, like, how do you decide what gets to be canonical?
Yes. I mean, like, how we can begin there. So, like, is there, like, there's a process, is there, to actually choose what is, like, in the canon?
Obviously, historically, the people who've decided what enters canon as, like, great literature have been, like, rich white men, generally.
Yeah.
And then in more recent times, we have been sort of writing back against that and rewriting the canon and, you know, focusing on people who are, like, incredibly talented that have been overlooked because of X, Y, or Z. And then, you know, reshaping the canon to more accurately reflect our world and quality rather than just like, oh, that group of dudes who are all really good friends and like read their poetry and wank off at the same time, they're all the canon, you know?
I mean, like, I do have the like experience when I read like any book that is thought of like as a classic. And like, if you don't know much about them, then you do some Googling, like, and you're like, oh, he was a count. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, of course he was. Okay.
You're like, oh, he was part of that really rich and famous circle, was he?
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. Has that changed how you, like, approach a classic then? Like, that knowledge of the bias process behind it?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like one thing you just have to acknowledge when you're talking about literature is that literature is a biased thing. Like, you know, sometimes we talk as if there is certain books which are undeniably good somehow. And it's just like, there's always going to be someone who doesn't like it.
Yeah.
Like, there is no objective actual, this is a thing of quality, you know. Like, it's kind of like a topic in regards to, like, literary awards. Some literary awards are really clear about their criteria and what they judge by. Like, how they determine who should be winning that award. Others are just like, this is our panel of judges. You only get to be in the panel of judges if you pay an exorbitant amount and you're really influential. And we're not actually going to tell you how we judge these pieces of literature. We're just going to pick our favorite.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, it's a similar thing, but on a grander scale, where it's like, how do we determine what is good and what is worth remembering and blah? And then classics often end up being things that over time, many, many people have said, yes, this one's a keeper.
Mm-hmm.
But you're always gonna, like, it's never gonna work for everyone. Some things are so mired in their particular time that it's really hard to, like, separate it out and that sort of thing. And I'm sort of trying to give you a waffly answer that means I don't actually have to define whether or not something should be in the canon or not.
Okay. I find, like, from my, like, experience, because, like, I had a period, like, in my teen years that most people probably have, where, like, you just read, like, either the same books, like, over and over again, or, like, just books that are more, like, appropriate for, like, your age.
Yeah.
And then you realise, like, well, not realise, but, like, you think, like, I always hear, like, about these books that, like, I should probably give some of them a try and see how I feel.
That's what I did with Frankenstein.
Yeah.
It was in that transitional phase where I was like, maybe I should go from reading just the things I find for fun and actually, like, try out some of these very well-considered things.
Yeah. And from my experience, like, I found that, like, even if I don't really, like, enjoy it, like, a lot of the things that are thought of as classics, I find there's, like, a lot more to say about them, even if I didn't really enjoy them. I feel like, and I kind of, like, speaking, like, really broadly here, obviously, they have generally more depth to them.
Sometimes it's stuff where you're like, for example, my example that I wheel out, Moby Dick.
Mm-hmm.
I had to study Moby Dick at university. I can write you a fucking good essay on Moby Dick. There is a lot to talk about.
Uh-huh.
It's a great epic of a length to mimic the size of the American continent. Uh-huh. It's a testament to the time, whaling, shit like that. God, it's a dull book for me to read personally.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And it's like, I see why some people love it. I see why there is a lot to analyze about it. But if I'm chilling out on a weekend and I want to read a book, I don't want to read Moby Dick.
Yes. Yeah, it's fair. I recently read, like, Anna Karenina, as you're aware of.
I am, yes.
And very similarly, I feel like a lot of the criticisms that could, like, very easily be thrown at it, I find hard to defend it against. Because, like, I feel like a lot of my defense for, like, if someone says that, like, it's really long and boring, is that life is really long and boring. Which, like, isn't a very good defense of the book.
And, like, it's like you're looking through a window at a distance and you're like, oh, that hill over there, that's the rambling prose that that person's going to find really dull.
Yes.
But that I'm reveling in and yes, having a wonderful time reading.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like, it's that thing where you're like, I see it, I hear you, I don't care.
Yeah, you can summarize the plot of, like, Anna Karenina in, like, two sentences. If you're coming to some of these classics for, like, for like an intense plot a lot of the time, then you're going to be let down. Because a lot of it doesn't come from plot, from my experience.
Yeah. But the film reduces it down and the film focuses on Anna. And, yeah, we have the other characters present, but I feel like the film is always putting the lens back on Anna. Whereas, when you actually read the book, even though it is named after her, like, she is one strand of many. She is not actually quite such a focal point as if you had watched an adaptation and thought, oh, I'd love to read the original. You might go into that original text and be like, who are all these other people and why do I care that he's working the land and embracing his inner farmer? You know, like,
yes, like, that kind of comes back around to the, like, expectations, like, if you came to Frankenstein and, like, expected what the films show you.
Like, I've had conversations with some of my friends who read Frankenstein and really hated it, and they're just like, you know, it waffles on, it takes so long for things to happen. And I'm like, I love those waffles that are all about, like, the nature of human existence.
Yeah.
And, like, his responsibility as someone who has brought life into this world and blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, when my friend was like, god, it was dull and it took forever, I'm like,
yeah, true, it does,
you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem in some ways with trying to establish, like, one singular canon, is it's just like, number one, that canon has been used historically to cement the structures that are already of suppression that are already in place, and it prioritizes the voices which are already dominant in the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely, like, in many ways there is a power that comes from rewriting that canon, yes. But also in some ways I just feel like sometimes you just need to acknowledge that maybe having, like, one method by which we assess things is not always that helpful.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yes. I'm going to ask you one final question. Like, in the same vein of making, like, an arbitrary qualification about what is good and what is not.
Okay, great.
What is your favourite classic monster? So I've got some examples here, like, if you would like some examples.
Sure.
Frankenstein. Dracula. Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. Werewolves. The Mummy. The Creature from the Black Lagoon. The Invisible Man.
Are we basing it on original source, or are we basing it on in popular culture?
In popular culture. So, like, far more broadly. Like, in the same way that, like, if you hear, like, some trashy film descriptions like Frankenstein versus Dracula, like, on the moon.
Yeah.
Which of these are you most likely to be like, ooh?
I have actually, rereading Dracula has really thrown me back to my preteen years where I read a lot of vampire fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, I now am on a precipice of really wanting to read vampire fiction that is very specifically not paranormal romance.
Okay.
But what I want is like classic vampire fiction.
Okay.
How about you?
As you might have guessed by me, I'm bringing it up like over and over again. I have a real soft spot for like big compilation things of classic monsters.
Yeah.
So things like Van Helsing or The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, where you just have this like it feels like almost like heretical in some form, where you're like shoving like all of these things that do not belong together and just kind of like shaking the bottle and seeing what happens.
I see it. I also feel like, not right now, there's a conversation for another time about how Van Helsing has entered popular culture versus what he's like in the original Dracula novel, because it is quite different, but carry on.
Okay. Is he not like Hugh Jackman?
He's just a Dutch doctor.
Okay.
He is not a vampire hunter. He just happens to know some stuff.
Oh, wow. That's not fun at all.
I know. Less fun. I understand why it's taken off.
Mm-hmm.
Carry on and pick your monster of choice.
I'm picking all of them. I'm picking them all, like, in a bottle, like, at the same time.
I didn't
time, like,
know picking all of them was an option, Mark. I might have gone for it.
If, like, anybody listening has any recommendations for, like, the trashiest of combinations of these kinds of characters, please let me know, because I really want to watch them.
Recommend that to Mark. Recommend to me, please, vampire fiction that is not just a romance, because I see it, I respect it, but I want like classic vampire. Yes, please.
I like how you've gone for like a challenging thing, and I'm just like, make it as trashy as possible, please.
Hardcore. Yes. I love a good monster mash.
Okay. You do the monster mash. I don't know how that song goes, so I can't sing it.
Well, you got the one line right.
Yeah.
Well done.
But the tune was entirely wrong.
It was a graveyard smash. Also, crucially, not a song that mentions Halloween, but is always played on Halloween. Monster Mash technically can happen every time. Anytime, anywhere. As long as you're in a graveyard and you're dancing.
Okay, I don't even know what the song is. So like, it sounds really strange to hear you talk about.
It's a bop.
Okay.
Give it a listen after this.
Okay.
At the end of each episode, we each assign a number of flailings to the thing that we've been discussing. How many flailings do you give Frankenstein?
So, if we're just talking about the book, I feel like I would be quite like enthusiastic if someone brought up the book, just because like it's just, I found it to be like a very like high quality book. But I feel like if it were to be like Frankenstein, as in the popular culture, he's like, out of that list, he's quite low down the list of, like, if I saw him in a thing, like, I wouldn't be like, ooh, Frankenstein. So the book, I would give a 6 or 7, maybe.
Okay.
And Frankenstein in popular culture, I'd probably give, like, a 2.
Okay. Interesting.
How about you?
I would give the book a 7, because
mm-hmm.
it's not my all-time favourite canonical classic text.
Mm-hmm.
But I do really like it. I'd probably give popular culture Frankenstein like a 5, because I think Frankenstein is such a hard thing to actually adapt accurately, so that I have a lot of affection for like the Hammer horror sort of style that has become like the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the aesthetics of Bride of Frankenstein, and to be honest with you, was quite disappointed that she was barely in the film.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I have like an interest in Frankenstein adaptations. I feel like I'm still looking for my perfect Frankenstein film, but I would be open to finding it.
Okay.
Conversely, I feel like I've come out of this with a lot more love for Dracula adaptations than for Frankenstein adaptations.
Okay, that's so ironic. I'm going to pitch you something that I've just thought of, and I want to know if you think that like it would work like as a monster mash.
Okay.
Do you think that a Dracula meets the Pre-Raphaelites would work?
I think it would work so well, because I just think, like, Dracula's a little bit extra.
Mm-hmm.
The Pre-Raphaelites are so extra. I feel like he'd drain them dry, you know? Like, they'd all be like, let's not put any garlic up in our house, we'll be fine. And then Dracula would be like, hey guys. I'd watch it.
Yeah.
I'd watch the heck out of that show.
Yeah.
And that's the end of this episode of You Know What I Like. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher and Podbean, and please leave a rating and a review. It helps other people find the show, and we'd love to be able to play it to more people.
We hope that you've enjoyed listening to us ramble, and please follow the podcast on Twitter at YKWILpodcast or drop us an email at YKWILpodcast@gmail.com. Come back next month where we get overly excited about Tekken. It might be a quiz.